The First Time Everything Changed by Gerald W. Bracey. By Sunday, October 6, 1957, most Americans had concluded that the beep, beep, beep from that thing called Sputnik, a man-made satellite that the Russians had supposedly sent into orbit on Friday, was not a hoax, not an electronic Potemkin village, a product of what we would today call special effects. Initially, the idea that Russian technology could surpass ours was unthinkable, and our brain's repression of Sputnik's reality was abetted by the implications that the putative orb carried. If they can send this thing over our heads, they can also attach an atomic bomb and drop it in our laps. Soon they will be dropping bombs on us from space like kids dropping rocks from freeway overpasses, said Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson. Writer Tom Wolfe described it this way, quote, "Nothing less than control of the heavens was at stake. It was Armageddon, the final and decisive battle of the forces of good and evil," end quote. According to journalist Paul Dixon, ministers spoke of the second coming, and at least one said, quote, "I wouldn't be surprised if he appeared today," end quote. The Condition of Education, 1957. Once the world realized that Sputnik was not a swindle, people had to explain how a technologically backward nation such as the Soviet Union could have accomplished such a feat. Maybe the Russians had spies and accomplices in the West. Maybe our fat and lazy materialism had done us in. Maybe. But with remarkable alacrity, a dominant theory emerged. The Russians beat us into space because they had better schools. In some cases, school critics blamed themselves for allowing progressive educators generally and the advocates for life adjustment education in particular to, quote, "fool the American people into believing that education can safely be left to the professional educators. The mood of America has changed. I doubt we can again be silenced," end quote. The speaker here was Admiral Hyman Rickover, an ardent advocate for a more traditional education. At that moment, the progressive movement was in tatters. It was badly fragmented and had taken major hits from Rickover and from Albert Lind's quackery in the public schools, Robert Hutchins' conflict in education, Mortimer Smith's diminished mind, Rudolf Flesch's Why Johnny Can't Read, and especially Arthur Bester's Educational Wastelands, The Retreat from Learning in Public Schools. U.S. News and World Report ran an interview with Bester in late 1956 under the title, "We Are Less Educated Than 50 Years Ago." After Sputnik, it brought him back for "What Went Wrong with U.S. Schools." Bester eschewed two common descriptors of life adjustment education, flapdoodle and gobbledygook, and said simply that, quote, "In the light of Sputnik, life adjustment education turns out to have been something perilously close to death adjustment for our nation and our children. We have wasted an appalling part of the time of our young people on trivialities. The Russians have had sense enough not to do so. That's why the first satellite bears the label Made in Russia," end quote. No doubt Bester believed what he said. Many people believed it. But it was utter nonsense. The U.S. could have beaten the Russians by over a year. Dwight David Eisenhower chose not to. Various public explanations for the Sputnik debacle came from no less a figure than former Nazi and rocket expert Wernher von Braun. Quote, "The main reason is that the United States had no ballistic missile program worth mentioning between 1945 and 1951. These 6 years during which the Russians obviously laid the groundwork for their large rocket program, are irretrievably lost. The United States went into a serious ballistic missile program only in 1951. Thus, our present dilemma is not due to the fact that we are not working hard enough now, but that we did not work hard enough during the first 6 to 10 years after the war." End quote. Von Braun did not point fingers in public at the dysfunctional squabbling involving the Army, Air Force, and Navy. Each service had a rocket program, and each jockeyed for which would get into orbit first. The civilian coordinating agency, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, would not exist until late 1958. At a secret briefing to Army officials 3 weeks after Sputnik orbited, von Braun did point to how scattered the programs were. Quote, "About a year ago, I saw a compilation of all guided missile projects which, at one time or another, had been activated in this country since 1945. I doubt if you will believe it, but the total figure was 119 different guided missile projects." End quote. Von Braun also did not mention how American scientists had neglected their homegrown rocketry genius, Robert Goddard. Von Braun had used Goddard's inventions to develop the V-1 buzz bomb and the far deadlier, supersonic and therefore silent, V-2 rocket that slammed tons of explosives into England during the late stages of World War II. But in 1920, when Goddard, under the aegis of the Smithsonian Institution, announced that he had invented a rocket that could explore deep space and might reach all the way to the moon, a New York Times editorial scoffed at the possibility. Everyone knew a rocket would be useless in a vacuum. Goddard, said the editors, quote, "seems to lack the knowledge ladled out daily in high schools," end quote. The Times had nothing more to say about Goddard's folly for 49 years. Then, on 17 July 1969, Apollo 11 sent Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins hurtling toward the moon. The Times referred to its 1920 editorial and commented, quote, "The Times regrets the error," end quote. Goddard died in 1945. But these were all public explanations. Von Braun himself knew differently. The real reason for the Russian primacy we might call Ike think. On 20 September 1956, von Braun's group, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency in Huntsville, Alabama, launched a 4-stage Jupiter C rocket from Cape Canaveral. The first 3 stages attained an altitude of 862 miles, a speed of 13,000 miles per hour, and a range of 3,355 miles, all records. Its 4th stage could have slipped from gravity's grasp and attained orbit. That is, if the 4th stage had contained rocket fuel. But the 4th stage was filled with sand. Eisenhower had fretted over the military's ability to determine Russian troop and submarine movements and bomber and missile capabilities. He was especially anxious about a possible surprise attack. The initial solution to improved intelligence was the U-2, a plane that soared above Russia's air defenses. But violations of a sovereign nation's airspace were illegal, making the U-2 a legitimate target for Russian surface-to-air missiles. When a Russian surface-to-air missile managed to shoot down the U-2 piloted by Gary Powers, the U.S. could only plead for his return and negotiate. The Russians eventually swapped Powers for a couple of Soviet spies then in U.S. custody. Eisenhower's ultimate goal was the creation of a system of spy satellites. But for that, he needed a precedent that would establish a doctrine that deep space was open space, international space. For that, von Braun's Jupiter C posed a problem. Von Braun's rocket was derived from and looked a lot like his V-2. It was part of the program to produce intercontinental ballistic missiles. Some analysts thought that the Soviets might view any orbiting satellite as a threat and not only complain about it, but threaten our allies. In an orbiting Jupiter C, the Russians would also see a vehicle launched by the detested ex-Nazi that was principally a weapon, not an instrument for exploration. On the other hand, the Navy's Vanguard program was predicated on smaller rockets and lighter payloads, payloads that would clearly announce themselves as instruments of research. Alas, the Vanguard program was behind schedule and, ultimately, behind Sputnik. Its post-Sputnik failures gave rise to headlines like Kaputnik, Flopnik, and Dudnik. Vanguard's schedule called for a November 1957 launch. This might well have caused the Russians to accelerate their own timetable. Vanguard finally pushed a 31-pound satellite into orbit on 31 March 1958. Eisenhower was casual about Sputnik. Indeed, his Deputy Secretary of Defense, Donald Quarles, announced that, quote, the Russians have, in fact, done us a good turn unintentionally in establishing a doctrine of freedom of space, end quote. Eisenhower himself wrote, quote, we felt certain that we could get a great deal more information of all kinds out of the free use of space than they could, end quote. It was a wonderful doctrine that opened space up to exploration, but one that educators paid a terrible price for. For his part, Ike was utterly perplexed that the success of Sputnik was seen to reflect a failed public school system. Sputnik speaks. Signals from Sputnik consisted only of a beep that lasted 0.3 seconds and a silence of the same duration. But the 184-pound beach ball-sized orb still spoke volumes. Physically, the easiest way to send something into orbit is to take it to the equator and launch it due east. That takes maximum advantage of the Earth's eastward spin. The Russians, though, launched Sputnik from southern Kazakhstan at a 65-degree angle to the equator. This required more thrust, but the resulting orbits carried Sputnik over most of the inhabited world, ensuring more coverage in the world's media. Given Russia's awesome accomplishment, U.S. allies might waver in their support. Non-aligned nations might tilt toward Moscow. When the Russians broadcast the times that Sputnik would arrive over various places, they included its appearance over Little Rock, Arkansas. On September 24th, President Eisenhower had ordered troops to escort the 9 black students who would integrate Little Rock High School. By announcing Sputnik's arrival times over Little Rock, Moscow attempted to signal to the world that the Soviet Union was the friend of oppressed people everywhere. And Lyndon Johnson's fear notwithstanding, Sputnik spoke not so much from what it actually was, but from what it portended. Quote, the science of today is the technology of tomorrow, end quote, said father of the H-bomb Edward Teller. Quote, many people are afraid that we will be attacked by Russia. I am not free of such worry. But I do not think this is the most probable way in which they will defeat us. They will advance so fast in science and leave us so far behind that their way of doing things will be the way, and there will be nothing we can do about it, end quote. More than the events of 9/11/2001 or 12/7/1941, to which it was often compared at the time, 10/4/1957 meant that everything had changed. U.S. defense was predicated on fleets of bombers stationed around the world. Were they now obsolete? In November 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik 2, which weighed in at over 1,100 pounds, not counting Laika, its puppy dog passenger. On 15 May 1958, Sputnik 3 carried 2,926 pounds into orbit. Sputnik 3 was less noticed by the public than Sputnik 1, but it got more attention from the U.S. military. Sputnik 3 implied that Russia had moved closer to having an operational intercontinental ballistic missile than anyone had previously thought. The condition of education 1957 continued. None of the technological aspects of the flight troubled Americans' thinking about Sputnik's meaning. It was the schools, stupid. Proof arrived with the issue of Life magazine for 24 March 1958. On the cover, the words "Crisis in Education" were emblazoned in red letters on a black background. The cover featured portraits of two high school juniors, Alexei Kutskov glaring out from Moscow, and an easy-smiling Stephen Lapikus gazing out from Chicago. Inside, pictures showed Alexei conducting complicated experiments in chemistry and physics and reading aloud from Theodore Dreiser's novel Sister Carrie in his English class. Out-of-school pictures showed him playing chess, standing in front of a bust of Russian composer Mikhail Glinka at a concert, and reading from an English-Russian phrasebook while riding the metro to a science museum. Text under pictures of two teachers indicated that they taught Alexei material considered too advanced for U.S. high schools, organic chemistry, and the theory of mathematical inequalities. By contrast, Lapikus is seen at a typewriter, "I type about one word a minute," the caption quotes him, and retreating from a geometry problem on the blackboard, caption, "Stephen amused class with wisecracks about his ineptitude." A picture of Stephen standing in front of the class reading from Victoria Regina is shot over a girl's shoulder and reveals her looking at Modern Romances magazine. Out-of-class pictures show Stephen walking his girlfriend to school, swimming 11 hours a week, says the text, and dancing in rehearsal for the school musical for 2 months, the text tells us. The litany of charges was almost endless. The Soviet Union was producing twice, or was it three times, as many engineers and scientists as we were. The average Soviet student was years ahead of even the brightest U.S. high schoolers. Not enough math and science were being offered in our high schools. Gifted students were being neglected. Other European countries' education systems were superior to our own. Schools were suffused with anti-intellectualism. Bester, a history professor, claimed that, quote, "we are less educated than 50 years ago," end quote. He claimed that the percentage of high school students taking some science had dropped from 84% in 1900 to 54% in 1950. Math taking had plummeted from 86% to 55%. For a historian, this was a remarkable statistical lapse. Apparently, Bester was not aware that in 1900, the high school graduation rate was 7%. It would hardly be surprising that students in such an elite group would be studying mathematics. By 1950, the graduation rate had moved past 60%. The response of educators to these claims was relatively lame. For some of the claims, there were no handy numbers. Paul Elicker, executive secretary of the National Association of Secondary School Principals, NASSP, offered one of the more elaborate rebuttals. Elicker showed that the millions of men who were tested by the Army in World War I posted a grade level of 6.8, while those tested for World War II scored at 10.5. This refuted, Elicker argued, Bester's charge that we were less educated now. Elicker also observed that we didn't have much reliable information about the Russian schools and related NASSP's experience of serving for 10 years as the agency to select a dozen public school students to study at a high-ranking school in England. Quote, they held their own with their English schoolmates, end quote, he wrote. Not exactly overwhelming evidence, but indicative of the difficulty in making any compelling data-based comparative statements in those days. As for the neglect of the gifted, Elicker pointed out that the number of programs for gifted and talented students was growing. Moreover, a Carnegie report from 1908 revealed large percentages of students admitted to elite schools with conditions. Students with conditions would today be called students in need of remedial courses. At Harvard, for instance, 49% of freshmen had conditions, while at Yale, the figure was 58%. Elicker observed that at these schools in the 1950s, there were no students with conditions. Finally, this, quote, scholarless American public high school, end quote, was also the greatest supplier of those tapped for the learned society Phi Beta Kappa. Still, inattention to the gifted became one of the major post-Sputnik themes among reformers. The Life magazine comparison of Lepikus and Kutzkov was just the opening round in a five-part series. The third in the series centered on the neglect of gifted students in American schools and described the plight of Barry Wickman of Rockwell City, Iowa, population 2,333 then, 2,088 now. Barry had an IQ of 162, which made him a mystery to both his parents and his school. The article emphasized his loneliness and inability to fit in. I want to like baseball, he sighs at one point. One of Barry's teachers complained that she had five students with reading difficulties, leaving her little time to cope with Barry's needs. His problems appear to have been complicated by what he later found out was dyscalculia, difficulties with numbers similar to dyslexia. Befriended by the Life magazine reporter and assisted by a move to Winchester, Virginia, where he fit in better, Barry finished high school, graduated from nearby James Madison University, and eventually obtained a Ph.D. in clinical psychology. Lepikus became a Navy pilot and then had a 30-year career as a commercial pilot for TWA. Kutzkov's fate remains unknown, although an English journalist told Lepikus's son that Kutzkov works for the Russian equivalent of the FAA. The critics speak and speak and speak. Sputnik set a nasty precedent that has become a persistent tendency. When a social crisis, real, imagined, or manufactured, appears, schools are the scapegoat of choice. When the crisis is resolved, they receive no credit. 2 years before the 1969 moonshot, schools came under fire for the urban violence then sweeping the nation. Fred Hechinger, then education writer for the New York Times, took a jaundiced view of that attack, quote, almost 10 years ago, when the first Soviet Sputnik went into orbit, the schools were blamed for America's lag in space. Last week, in the Senate, the schools were blamed for the ghetto riots. In each case, the politicians' motives were suspect. Their reflex reaction when faced with a national crisis is to assign guilt to persons with the least power to hit back. The schools, which are non-political but dependent on political purse strings, fill the bill of emergency whipping boy, end quote. In 1969, a mere 12 years after Sputnik, Americans landed men on the moon and returned them safely to Earth. The moon is a heavenly object that the Russians, for all their superior schools, vaunted technology, and numerous attempts, never managed to even hit. No one suggested that improved schools might have had anything to do with the mission's success. And no doubt they did not. As Cap'n editor Stanley Elam pointed out in a gutsy piece, all 53 NASA scientists and engineers who responded to a PDK survey had finished high school before 1958. I say gutsy because Elam titled the article, "The Schools Behind the Masters of the Moon," and published it in the September 1969 issue. That issue would have been ready to go to press before Armstrong took his giant leap for mankind. The success of Apollo 11 was by no means assured, as those of us can attest who held our breath in the long silence on July 20th before hearing the words, "The Eagle has landed." In the early 1980s, America's captains of industry had grown lazy about making steel and building cars, while the Germans, Koreans, and especially the Japanese had zipped ahead of us. Must be the schools. Quote, "If only to keep and improve on the slim lead we retain in world markets, we must dedicate ourselves to the reform of our educational system," end quote, intoned the authors of That Golden Treasury of Spun Statistics, A Nation at Risk, in 1983. By 1992, Japan had discovered that the emperor's palace and grounds really were not more valuable than the entire state of California. Japan's bubble had burst, and its economy was in free fall. It has only recently recovered. All during the 15 years of recession and stagnation, Japan's kids continued to ace tests, but their stellar academic performance didn't goose their economy. And U.S. schools, in the meantime, they bore the brunt of continual grousing that lousy schools are producing a lousy workforce. This complaining lasted through the recession that cost George H.W. Bush a second term. By the time Bill Clinton entered the White House in 1992, though, things were looking better. By February 1994, the New York Times felt comfortable running a long story under the headline, "The American Economy Back on Top." 3 months later, IBM CEO Louis Gerstner took to the Times op-ed page with, "Our schools are broken." This hypocrisy elicited a bit of acid in response from Stanford University professor Larry Cuban. Quote, "For the last decade, U.S. presidents, corporate leaders, and critics blasted public schools for a globally less competitive economy, sinking productivity, and jobs lost to other nations. Why is it now, with a bustling economy, rising productivity, and shrinking unemployment, American public schools are not receiving credit for the turnaround?"